Nobody should worry about the exact ebbs and flows, but if the needs of one side change on a sustained basis, the financial arrangement will need to be readjusted to establish a new, appropriate relationship. Principle 2.3. Recognize that the size of the organization can pose a threat to meaningful relationships. When there were just a few of us, we had meaningful relationships because we knew and liked each other. When we grew to between 50 and 100 people, we had a community. When we grew beyond that, the sense of community began to slip because we didn't all know each other in the same way. That's when I realized that having groups, departments of around 100, give or take about 50, that are bound collectively by our common mission was the best way to scale the meaningful relationship. While bigger companies tend to be more impersonal, that is just another challenge that has to be figured out. Principle 2.4. Remember that most people will pretend to operate in your interest while operating in their own. For example, most people will operate in a way that maximizes the amount of money they will get and that minimizes the amount of work they have to do to get it. To see this, just leave someone unsupervised and allow them to bill you for what they've done. Be especially wary of this conflict of interest when people are advising you on matters that will affect how much money they earn, such as the lawyer who spends a lot of billable hours giving you advice, or the salesperson who advises you on what to purchase while receiving a commission on the amount that you spend. You can't imagine how many people I meet who are eager to help me. Don't be naive. Strive for the highest possible percentage of your population having meaningful work and meaningful relationships, while recognizing that there will always be some percentage of the population who won't care for the community and or will do it harm. Principle 2.5. Treasure honorable people who are capable and will treat you well even when you're not looking. They are rare. Such relationships take time to build and can only be built if you treat such people well. Chapter 3. Create a culture in which it is okay to make mistakes and unacceptable not to learn from them. Everyone makes mistakes. The main difference is that successful people learn from them and unsuccessful people don't. By creating an environment in which it is okay to safely make mistakes so that people can learn from them, you'll see rapid progress and fewer significant mistakes. This is especially true in organizations where creativity and independent thinking are important, as success will inevitably require the acceptance of failure as a part of the process. As Thomas Edison once said, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that do not work." Mistakes will cause you pain, but you shouldn't try to shield yourself or others from it. Pain is a message that something is wrong, and it's an effective teacher that one shouldn't do that wrong thing again. To deal with your own and others' weaknesses well, you must acknowledge them frankly and openly and work to find ways of preventing them from hurting you in the future. It's at this point that many people say, "No thanks, this isn't for me, I'd rather not have to deal with these things." But this is against your and your organization's best interests and will keep you from achieving your goals. It seems to me that if you look back on yourself a year ago and aren't shocked by how stupid you were, you haven't learned much. Still, few people go out of their way to embrace their mistakes. It doesn't have to be that way. Remember back in Life Principles when I told the story about the time that Ross, then our head of trading, forgot to put in a trade for a client? The money just sat there in cash, and by the time the mistake was discovered, it had cost the client, actually Bridgewater, because we had to make good on it, a lot of money. It was terrible, and I could easily have fired Ross to make the point that nothing less than perfection will be accepted, but that would have been counterproductive. I would have lost a good man, and it would have only encouraged other employees to hide their mistakes, creating a culture that would not only be dishonest, but crippled in its ability to learn and grow. If Ross hadn't experienced that pain, he and Bridgewater would have been the worse for it. The point I made by not firing Ross was much more powerful than firing him would have been. I was demonstrating to him and others that it was okay to make mistakes and unacceptable not to learn from them. After the dust settled, Ross and I worked together to build an error log. We now call it the issue log, in which traders recorded all their mistakes and bad outcomes so we could track them and address them systematically. It has become one of the most powerful tools we have at Bridgewater. Our environment is one in which people understand that remarks such as, "You handled that badly," are meant to be helpful rather than punitive. Of course, in managing others who make mistakes, it is important to know the difference between 1. Capable people who made mistakes and are self-reflective and open to learning from them, and 2. Incapable people or capable people who aren't able to embrace their mistakes and learn from them. Over time, I've found that hiring self-reflective people like Ross is one of the most important things I can do. Finding this kind of person isn't easy. I've often thought that parents and schools overemphasize the value of having the right answers all the time. It seems to me that the best students in school tend to be the worst at learning from their mistakes because they've been conditioned to associate mistakes with failure instead of opportunity. This is a major impediment to their progress. Intelligent people who embrace their mistakes and weaknesses substantially outperform their peers who have the same abilities but bigger ego barriers. Principle 3.1. Recognize that mistakes are a natural part of the evolutionary process. If you don't mind being wrong on the way to being right, you'll learn a lot and increase your effectiveness. But if you can't tolerate being wrong, you won't grow, you'll make yourself and everyone around you miserable, and your work environment will be marked by petty backbiting and malevolent barbs rather than by a healthy, honest search for truth. You must not let your need to be right be more important than your need to find out what's true. Jeff Bezos described it well when he said, "You have to have a willingness to repeatedly fail. If you don't have a willingness to fail, you're going to have to be very careful not to invent." A. Fail well. Everyone fails. Anyone you see succeeding is only succeeding at the things you're paying attention to. I guarantee they are also failing at lots of other things. The people I respect most are those who fail well. I respect them even more than those who succeed. That is because failing is a painful experience while succeeding is a joyous one, so it requires much more character to fail, change, and then succeed than to just succeed. People who are just succeeding must not be pushing their limits. Of course, the worst are those who fail and don't recognize it and don't change. B. Don't feel bad about your mistakes or those of others. Love them. People typically feel bad about their mistakes because they think in a short-sighted way about the bad outcome and not about the evolutionary process of which mistakes are an integral part. I once had a ski instructor who had also given lessons to Michael Jordan, the greatest basketball player of all time. Jordan, he told me, reveled in his mistakes, seeing each of them as an opportunity to improve. He understood that mistakes are like those little puzzles that when you solve them, give you a gem. Every mistake that you make and learn from will save you from thousands of similar mistakes in the future. Principle 3.2. Don't worry about looking good. Worry about achieving your goals. Put your insecurities away and get on with achieving your goals. Reflect and remind yourself that an accurate criticism is the most valuable feedback you can receive. Imagine how silly and unproductive it would be to respond to your ski instructor as if he were blaming you when he told you that you fell because you didn't shift your weight properly. It's no different if a supervisor points out a flaw in your work progress. Fix it and move on. A. Get over blame and credit and get on with accurate and inaccurate. Worrying about blame and credit or positive and negative feedback impedes the iterative process that is essential to learning. Remember that what has already happened lies in the past and no longer matters except as a lesson for the future. The need for phony praise needs to be unlearned. Principle 3.3. Observe the patterns of mistakes to see if they are products of weaknesses. Everyone has weaknesses, and they are generally revealed in the patterns of mistakes they make. The fastest path to success starts with knowing what your weaknesses are and staring hard at them. Start by writing down your mistakes and connecting the dots between them. Then write down your one big challenge, the weakness that stands the most in the way of your getting what you want. Everyone has at least one big challenge. You may, in fact, have several, but don't go beyond your big three. The first step to tackling these impediments is getting them out into the open. Principle 3.4. Remember to reflect when you experience pain. Remember this. The pain is all in your head. If you want to evolve, you need to go where the problems and the pain are. By confronting the pain, you will see more clearly the paradoxes and problems you face. Reflecting on them and resolving them will give you wisdom. The harder the pain and the challenge, the better. Because these moments of pain are so important, you shouldn't rush through them. Stay in them and explore them so you can build a foundation for improvement. Embracing your failures and confronting the pain they cause you and others is the first step toward genuine improvement. It is why confession precedes forgiveness in many societies. Psychologists call this hitting bottom. If you keep doing this, you will convert the pain of facing your mistakes and weaknesses into pleasures and get to the other side, as I explained in Embrace Reality and Deal With It. A. Be self-reflective and make sure your people are self-reflective. When there is pain, the animal instinct is fight or flight. Calm yourself down and reflect instead. The pain you are feeling is due to things being in conflict. Maybe you've come up against a terrible reality, such as the death of a friend, and are unable to accept it. Maybe you've been forced to acknowledge a weakness that challenges the idea you'd had of yourself. If you can think clearly about what's behind it, you will learn more about what reality is like and how to better deal with it. Self-reflectiveness is the quality that most differentiates those who evolve quickly from those who don't. Remember, pain plus reflection equals progress. B. Know that nobody can see themselves objectively. While we should all strive to see ourselves objectively, we shouldn't expect everyone to be able to do that well. We all have blind spots. People are by definition subjective. For this reason, it is everyone's responsibility to help others learn what is true about themselves by giving them honest feedback, holding them accountable, and working through disagreements in an open-minded way. C. Teach and reinforce the merits of mistake-based learning. To encourage people to bring their mistakes into the open and analyze them objectively, managers need to foster a culture that makes this normal and that penalizes suppressing or covering up mistakes. We do this by making it clear that one of the worst mistakes anyone can make is not facing up to their mistakes. This is why the use of the issue log is mandatory at Bridgewater. Principle 3.5. Know what types of mistakes are acceptable and what types are unacceptable, and don't allow the people who work for you to make the unacceptable ones. When considering the kinds of mistakes you're willing to allow in order to promote learning through trial and error, weigh the potential damage of a mistake against the benefit of incremental learning. In defining what latitude I'm willing to give people, I say, I'm willing to let you scratch or dent the car, but I won't put you in a position where there's a significant risk of your totaling it. Pain plus reflection equals progress. Chapter 4. Get and Stay in Sync. Remember that for an organization to be effective, the people who make it up must be aligned on many levels, from what their shared mission is to how they will treat each other, to a more practical picture of who will do what when to achieve their goals. Yet alignment can never be taken for granted because people are wired so differently. We all see ourselves and the world in our own unique ways, so deciding what's true and what to do about it takes constant work. Alignment is especially important in an idea meritocracy, so at Bridgewater we try to attain alignment consciously, continually, and systematically. We call this process of finding alignment getting in sync, and there are two primary ways it can go wrong: cases resulting from simple misunderstandings and those stemming from fundamental disagreements. Getting in sync is the process of open-mindedly and assertively reflecting on both types. Many people mistakenly believe that papering over differences is the easiest way to keep the peace. They couldn't be more wrong. By avoiding conflicts, one avoids resolving differences. People who suppress minor conflicts tend to have much bigger conflicts later on, which can lead to separation, while people who address their mini conflicts head-on tend to have the best and longest-lasting relationships. Thoughtful disagreement, the process of having a quality back and forth in an open-minded and assertive way so as to see things through each other's eyes, is powerful because it helps both parties see things they've been blind to. But it's not easy. While it is straightforward to have a meritocracy in activities in which there is a clarity of relative abilities, because the results speak for themselves, such as in sports where the fastest runner wins the race, it is much harder in a creative environment where different points of view about what's best have to be resolved. If they're not, the process of sorting through disagreements and knowing who has the authority to decide quickly becomes chaotic. Sometimes people get angry or stuck. A conversation can easily wind up with two or more people spinning unproductively and unable to reach agreement on what to do. For these reasons, specific processes and procedures must be followed. Every party to the discussion must understand who has what rights and which procedures should be followed to move toward resolution. We've also developed tools for helping do this, which you will hear later in the appendix. And everyone must understand the most fundamental principle for getting in sync, which is that people must be open-minded and assertive at the same time. Thoughtful disagreement is not a battle. Its goal is not to convince the other party that he or she is wrong and that you are right, but to find out what is true and what to do about it. It must also be non-hierarchical, because in an idea meritocracy, communication doesn't just flow unquestioned from the top down. Criticisms must also come from the bottom up. For example, this email was sent to me by someone who worked for me after a meeting with clients. All the senior people at Bridgewater, including me, are routinely criticized and judged by our subordinates. From Jim H. to Ray, Lionel K., Greg J., Randall S., David A. Subject, feedback on ABC meeting. Ray, you deserve a D- for your performance today in the ABC meeting, and everyone that was in the room that saw you agrees on that harsh assessment, give or take half a grade. This was especially disappointing for two reasons. One, you have been great in previous meetings where the subject matter to be covered was the same, and two, we held a specific planning meeting yesterday to ask you to focus tightly on culture and portfolio structuring because we had only 2 hours to have you cover those two topics. Me cover the investment process, have Greg do the observatory, and have Randall do implementation. Instead, you took a total of 62 minutes, I measured, but worse, you rambled for 50 minutes on what I think was portfolio structuring topics and only then got to culture, and you talked about that for 12 minutes. It was obvious to all of us that you did not prepare at all, because there is no way you could have been that disorganized at the outset if you had prepared. Similarly, I'd like to share another case in which one of our senior managers observed a conversation between Greg Jensen, who was then CEO, and a junior employee, and felt that Greg was speaking to that employee in a way that discouraged dissent and independent thinking. She raised this in feedback she gave Greg. Greg disagreed, asserting that he was simply reminding the employee of relevant principles and her responsibilities to either adhere to them or openly question them. The two sought to get in sync through a series of emails, and when that didn't work, they raised their disagreement to the management committee. A case based on the meeting in question was sent to the entire company so everyone could judge for themselves who was right and who was wrong. It was a good learning exercise that Greg and the senior manager appreciated. We used it to reflect on our written principles for handling situations like this, and they both got a lot of useful feedback. If we hadn't laid out our principles and used them to judge cases like this, we would have people with power making decisions however they wanted instead of in mutually agreed upon ways. The principles that follow flesh out how we do this. If they are adhered to, you will be well aligned with others and your idea meritocracy will hum with productivity. If they are not, it will grind to a halt. Principle 4.1. Recognize that conflicts are essential for great relationships, because they are how people determine whether their principles are aligned and resolve their differences. Everyone has his or her own principles and values, so all relationships entail a certain amount of negotiation or debate over how people should be with each other. What you learn about each other will either draw you together or drive you apart. If your principles are aligned and you can work out your differences via a process of give and take, you will draw closer together. If not, you will move apart. Open discussion or differences ensures that there are no misunderstandings. If that doesn't happen on an ongoing basis, gaps in perspective will widen until inevitably there is a major clash. A. Spend lavishly on the time and energy you devote to getting in sync because it's the best investment you can make. In the long run, it saves time by increasing efficiency, but it's important that you do it well. You will need to prioritize what you are going to get in sync about and who you are going to get in sync with because of time constraints. Your highest priority should be the most important issues with the most believable and most relevant parties. Principle 4.2. Know how to get in sync and disagree well. It is harder to run an idea meritocracy in which disagreements are encouraged than a top-down autocracy in which they are suppressed. But when believable parties to disagreements are willing to learn from each other, their evolution is faster and their decision-making is far better. The key is in knowing how to move from disagreement to decision-making. It is important that the paths for doing this are clear so that who is responsible for doing what is known. That is the reason I created a tool called the Dispute Resolver, which lays out the paths and makes clear to everyone if they are holding on to a different point of view rather than moving it along to resolution. You can hear about it in the Tools appendix. It is essential to know where the ultimate decision-making authority lies. That is, how far the power of the argument will carry relative to the power of the assigned authority. While arguing, and especially after a decision is rendered, everyone in the idea meritocracy must remain calm and respectful of the process. It is never acceptable to get upset if the idea meritocracy doesn't produce the decision that you personally wanted. A. Surface areas of possible out-of-syncness. If you and others don't raise your perspectives, there's no way you will resolve your disputes. You can surface the areas of disagreement informally or put them on a list to go over. I personally like to do both, though I encourage people to list their disagreements in order of priority, so I and we can more easily direct them to the right party at the right time. The nubbiest questions, the ones that there is the greatest disagreement about, are the most important ones to thrash out, as they often concern differences in people's values or their approaches to important decisions. It's especially important to bring these issues to the surface and examine their premises thoroughly and unemotionally. If you don't, they will fester and cause rot. B. Distinguish between idle complaints and complaints meant to lead to improvement. Many complaints either fail to take into account the full picture or reflect a closed-minded point of view. They are what I call chirping and are generally best ignored. But constructive complaints may lead to important discoveries. C. Remember that every story has another side. Wisdom is the ability to see both sides and weigh them appropriately. Principle 4.3. Be open-minded and assertive at the same time. Being effective at thoughtful disagreement requires one to be open-minded, seeing things through others' eyes, and assertive, communicating clearly how things look through your eyes, and to flexibly process this information to create learning and adaptation. I have found that most people have problems being assertive and open-minded at the same time. Typically, they are more inclined to be assertive than open-minded because it's easier to convey how they see things than to understand how others do. And also because people tend to have ego attachments to being right, though some people are too willing to accept others' views at the expense of their own. It's important to remind people that they have to do both, and to remember that decision-making is a two-step process in which one has to take in information as well as decide. It also helps to remind people that those who change their minds are the biggest winners because they learned something, whereas those who stubbornly refuse to see the truth are losers. With practice, training, and constant reinforcement, anyone can get good at this. A. Distinguish open-minded people from closed-minded people. Open-minded people seek to learn by asking questions. They realize how little they know in relation to what there is to know, and recognize that they might be wrong. They are thrilled to be around people who know more than they do because it represents an opportunity to learn something. Closed-minded people always tell you what they know, even if they know hardly anything. They are typically uncomfortable being around those who know a lot more than they do. B. Don't have anything to do with closed-minded people. Being open-minded is much more important than being bright or smart. No matter how much they know, closed-minded people will waste your time. If you must deal with them, recognize that there can be no helping them until they open their minds. C. Watch out for people who think it's embarrassing not to know. They're likely to be more concerned with appearances than actually achieving the goal. This can lead to ruin over time. D. Make sure that those in charge are open-minded about the questions and comments of others. The person responsible for a decision must be able to explain the thinking behind it openly and transparently so that everyone can understand and assess it. In the event of disagreement, an appeal should be made to either the decision-maker's boss or an agreed-upon, knowledgeable group of others, generally people more knowledgeable than and senior to the decision-maker. E. Recognize that getting in sync is a two-way responsibility. In any conversation, there is a responsibility to express and a responsibility to listen. Misinterpretations and misunderstandings are always going to happen. Often, difficulty in communication is due to people having different ways of thinking. For example, left-brain thinkers talking to right-brain thinkers. The parties involved should always consider the possibility that one or both of them misunderstood and do a back and forth so that they can get in sync. Very simple tricks like repeating what you're hearing someone say to make sure you're actually getting it can be invaluable. Start by assuming you're either not communicating or listening well, instead of blaming the other party. Learn from your miscommunications so they don't happen again. F. Worry more about substance than style. This is not to say that some styles aren't more effective than others with different people and in different circumstances, but I often hear people complaining about the style or tone of a criticism in order to deflect from its substance. If you think someone's style is an issue, box it as a separate issue to get in sync on. G. Be reasonable and expect others to be reasonable. You have a responsibility to be reasonable and considerate when you are advocating for your point of view and should never let your lower-level you gain control, even if the other person loses his or her temper. Their bad behavior doesn't justify yours. If either party to a disagreement is too emotional to be logical, the conversation should be deferred. Pausing a few hours or even a few days in cases where decisions do not have to be made immediately is sometimes the best approach. H. Making suggestions and questioning are not the same as criticizing, so don't treat them as if they are. A person making suggestions may not have concluded that a mistake will be made. They could just be making doubly sure that the person they're talking to has taken all the risks into consideration. Asking questions to make sure that someone hasn't overlooked something isn't the same thing as saying that he or she has overlooked it. Watch out for the ice versus you're being careless and not looking out for the ice. Yet I often see people react to constructive questions as if they were accusations. That is a mistake. Principle 4.4. If it is your meeting to run, manage the conversation. There are many reasons why meetings go poorly, but frequently it is because of a lack of clarity about the topic or the level at which things are being discussed. For example, the principal machine level, the case at hand level, or the specific fact level. A. Make it clear who is directing the meeting and whom it is meant to serve. Every meeting should be aimed at achieving someone's goals. That person is the one responsible for the meeting and decides what they want to get out of it and how they will do so. Meetings without someone clearly responsible run a high risk of being directionless and unproductive. B. Be precise in what you're talking about to avoid confusion. It is often best to repeat a specific question to be sure both questioner and responder are crystal clear on what is being asked and answered. In an email, this is often as simple as cutting and pasting the questions into the body of the text. C. Make clear what type of communication you're going to have in light of the objectives and priorities. If your goal is to have people with different opinions work through their differences to try to get closer to what is true and what to do about it, open-minded debate, you will run your meeting differently than if its goal is to educate. Debating takes time, and that time increases exponentially depending on the number of people participating in the discussion. So you have to carefully choose the right people in the right numbers to suit the decision that needs to be made. In any discussion, try to limit the participation to those whom you value most in light of your objectives. The worst way to pick people is based on whether their conclusions align with yours. Groupthink, people not asserting independent views, and solothink, people being unreceptive to the thoughts of others, are both dangerous. D. Lead the discussion by being assertive and open-minded. Reconciling different points of view can be difficult and time-consuming. It is up to the meeting leader to balance conflicting perspectives, push through impasses, and decide how to spend time wisely. A common question I get is, what happens when someone inexperienced offers an opinion? If you're running the conversation, you should be weighing the potential cost and the time that it takes to explore their opinion versus the potential gain in being able to assess their thinking and gain a better understanding of what they're like. Exploring the views of people who are still building their track record can give you valuable insights into how they might handle various responsibilities. Time permitting, you should work through their reasoning with them so they can understand how they might be wrong. It's also your obligation to open-mindedly consider whether they're right. E. Navigate between the different levels of the conversation. When considering an issue or situation, there should be two levels of discussion: the case at hand and the relevant principles that help you decide how the machine should work. You need to clearly navigate between these levels in order to handle the case well, test the effectiveness of your principles, and improve the machine so similar cases will be handled better in the future. F. Watch out for topic slip. Topic slip is random drifting from topic to topic without achieving completion on any of them. One way to avoid it is by tracking the conversation on a whiteboard so that everyone can see where you are. G. Enforce the logic of conversations. People's emotions tend to heat up when there is disagreement. Remain calm and analytical at all times. It is more difficult to shut down a logical exchange than an emotional one. Remember, too, that emotions can shade how people see reality. For example, people will sometimes say, "I feel like something is true," and proceed as though it's a fact, when other people may interpret the same situation differently. Ask them, "Is it true?" to ground the conversation in reality. H. Be careful not to lose personal responsibility via group decision-making. Too often, groups will make a decision to do something without assigning personal responsibilities, so it is not clear who is supposed to follow up by doing what. Be clear in assigning personal responsibilities. I. Utilize the 2-minute rule to avoid persistent interruptions. The 2-minute rule specifies that you have to give someone an uninterrupted 2 minutes to explain their thinking before jumping in with your own. This ensures that everyone has time to fully crystallize and communicate their thoughts without worrying they will be misunderstood or drowned out by a louder voice. J. Watch out for assertive fast talkers. Fast talkers are people who articulately and assertively say things faster than they can be assessed as a way of pushing their agenda past other people's examination or objections. Fast talking can be especially effective when it's used against people worried about appearing stupid. Don't be one of those people. Recognize that it's your responsibility to make sense of things, and don't move on until you do. If you're feeling pressured, say something like, "Sorry for being stupid, but I'm going to need to slow you down so I can make sense of what you're saying." Then ask your questions, all of them. K. Achieve completion in conversations. The main purpose of discussion is to achieve completion and get in sync, which leads to decisions and/or actions. Conversations that fail to reach completion are a waste of time. When there is an exchange of ideas, it is important to end it by stating the conclusions. If there is agreement, say it. If not, say that. Where further action has been decided, get those tasks on a to-do list, assign people to do them, and specify due dates. Write down your conclusions, working theories, and to-dos in places that will lead to their being used as foundations for continued progress. To make sure this happens, assign someone to make sure notes are taken and follow-through occurs. There is no reason to get angry because you still disagree. People can have a wonderful relationship and disagree about some things. You don't have to agree on everything. L. Leverage your communication. While open communication is very important, the challenge is to do it in a time-efficient way. You can't have individual conversations with everyone. It is helpful to identify easy ways of sharing, like open emails posted on a frequently asked questions board, or sending around videotapes or audio recordings of key meetings. I call such approaches leverage. The challenges become greater the higher you go in the reporting hierarchy because the number of people affected by your actions and who also have opinions and/or questions grows so large. In such cases, you will need even greater leverage and prioritization. For example, by having some of the questions answered by a well-equipped party who works for you, or by asking people to prioritize their questions by urgency or importance. Principle 4.5. Great collaboration feels like playing jazz. In jazz, there's no script. You have to figure things out as you go along. Sometimes you need to sit back and let others drive things, other times you blare it out yourself. To do the right thing at the right moment, you need to really listen to the people you're playing with so that you can understand where they're going. All great creative collaboration should feel the same way. Combining your different skills like different instruments, improvising creatively, and at the same time, subordinating yourself to the goals of the group leads to playing great music together. But it's important to keep in mind what number of collaborators will play well together. A talented duo can improvise beautifully, as can a trio or quartet. But gather 10 musicians, and no matter how talented they are, it's probably going to be too many, unless they're carefully orchestrated. A. 1 + 1 = 3. Two people who collaborate well will be about 3 times as effective as each of them operating independently, because each will see what the other might miss. Plus, they can leverage each other's strengths while holding each other accountable to higher standards. B. 3 to 5 is more than 20. 3 to 5 smart, conceptual people seeking the right answers in an open-minded way will generally lead to the best answers. It may be tempting to convene a larger group, but having too many people collaborate is counterproductive, even if the members of the larger group are smart and talented. The symbiotic advantages of adding people to a group grow incrementally. 2 plus 1 equals 4.25, up to a point. Beyond that, adding people actually subtracts from effectiveness. That is because, 1, the marginal benefits diminish as the group gets larger. 2 or 3 people might be able to cover most of the important perspectives, so adding more people doesn't bring much more. And 2, larger group interactions are less efficient than smaller ones. Of course, what's best in practice depends on the quality of the people and the differences of the perspectives that they bring, and how well the group is managed. Principle 4.6. When you have alignment, cherish it. While there is nobody in the world who will share your point of view on everything, there are people who will share your most important values and the ways in which you choose to live them out. Make sure you end up with those people. Principle 4.7. If you find you can't reconcile major differences, especially in values, consider whether the relationship is worth preserving. There are all kinds of different people in the world, many of whom value different kinds of things. If you find you can't get in sync with someone on shared values, you should consider whether that person is worth keeping in your life. A lack of common values will lead to a lot of pain and other harmful consequences, and may ultimately drive you apart. It might be better to head all of that off as soon as you see it coming. Chapter 5. Believability weight your decision-making. In typical organizations, most decisions are made either autocratically, by a top-down leader, or democratically, where everyone shares their opinions and those opinions that have the most support are implemented. Both systems produce inferior decision-making. That's because the best decisions are made by an idea meritocracy with believability-weighted decision-making, in which the most capable people work through their disagreements with other capable people who have thought independently about what is true and what to do about it. It is far better to weight the opinions of more capable decision-makers more heavily than those of less capable decision-makers. This is what we mean by believability weighting. So how do you determine who is capable at what? The most believable opinions are those of people who, 1, have repeatedly and successfully accomplished the thing in question, and 2, have demonstrated that they can logically explain the cause-effect relationships behind their conclusions. When believability weighting is done correctly and consistently, it is the fairest and most effective decision-making system. It not only produces the best outcomes, but also preserves alignment, since even people who disagree with the decision will be able to get behind it. But for this to be the case, the criteria for establishing believability must be objective and trusted by everybody. At Bridgewater, everyone's believability is tracked and measured systematically, using tools such as baseball cards and the dot collector that actively record and weigh their experience and track records. In meetings, we regularly take votes about various issues via our dot collector app, which displays both the equal-weighted average and the believability-weighted results, along with each person's vote. Typically, if both the equal-weighted average and the believability-weighted votes align, we consider the matter resolved and move on. If the two types of votes are at odds, we try again to resolve them, and if we can't, we go with the believability-weighted vote. Depending on what type of decision it is, in some cases a single responsible party, RP, can override a believability-weighted vote. In others, the believability-weighted vote supersedes the RP's decision. But in all cases, believability-weighted votes are taken seriously when there is disagreement. Even in cases in which the RPs can overrule the believability-weighted vote, the onus is on the RP to try to resolve the dispute before overruling it. In my 40 years at Bridgewater, I never made a decision contrary to the believability-weighted decision, because I felt that to do so was arrogant and counter to the spirit of the idea meritocracy, though I argued like hell for what I thought was best. To give you an example of what this process looks like in action, during the spring of 2012, our research teams used believability-weighted decision-making to resolve a disagreement about what would happen next as the European debt crisis was heating up. At that time, the borrowing and debt service needs of the governments of Italy, Ireland, Greece, Portugal, and especially Spain had reached levels that far exceeded their abilities to pay. We knew that the European Central Bank would either have to make unprecedented purchases of government bonds, or allow the debt crisis to worsen to the point where defaults and the breakup of the Eurozone would probably occur. Germany was adamantly opposed to a bailout. It was clear that the fates of these countries' economies and the Eurozone itself depended on how well Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, orchestrated the ECB's next move. But what would he do? Like analyzing a chessboard to visualize the implications and inclinations of the different moves of the different players, each of us looked at the situation from every angle. After a lot of discussion, we remained split. About half of us thought the ECB would print more money to buy the bonds, and about half thought they wouldn't, because breaking with the Germans would threaten the Eurozone even more. While such thoughtful and open exchanges are essential, it's also critical to have mutually agreed upon ways of resolving them to arrive at the best decision. So we used our believability weighting system to break the stalemate. We did that using our dot collector tool, which helps us surface the sources of our disagreements and people's different thinking characteristics and work our way through them based on their believabilities. People have different believability weightings for different qualities, like expertise in a particular subject, creativity, ability to synthesize, etc. These dots are determined by a mixture of ratings, both from peers and tests of different sorts. By looking at these attributes and also understanding which thinking qualities are most essential to the situation at hand, we can make the best decisions. In this case, we took a believability-weighted vote, with the qualities chosen being both subject matter expertise and ability to synthesize. Using the dot collector, it became clear that those with greater believability believed Draghi would defy Germany and print money. So that is what we went with. A few days later, European policymakers announced a sweeping plan to buy unlimited quantities of government bonds, so we got it right. While the believability-weighted answer isn't always the best answer, we have found that it is more likely to be right than either the boss's answer or an equal-weighted referendum. Regardless of whether or not you use this kind of technology and structured process for believability-weighting, the most important thing is that you get the concept. Simply look down on yourself and your team when a decision needs to be made and consider who is most likely to be right. I assure you that if you do, you will make better decisions than if you don't. Principle 5.1. Recognize that having an effective idea meritocracy requires that you understand the merit of each person's ideas. Having a hierarchy of merit is not only consistent with an idea meritocracy, but essential for it. It's simply not possible for everyone to debate everything all the time and still get their work done. Treating all people equally is more likely to lead away from truth than toward it. But at the same time, all views should be considered in an open-minded way, though placed in the proper context of the experiences and track records of the people expressing them. Imagine if a group of us were getting a lesson in how to play baseball from Babe Ruth, and someone who'd never played the game kept interrupting him to debate how to swing the bat. Would it be helpful or harmful to the group's progress to ignore their different track records and experience? Of course it would be harmful, and plain silly to treat their points of view equally because they have different levels of believability. The most productive approach would be to allow Ruth to give his instructions uninterrupted, and then take some time afterward to answer questions. But because I'm pretty extreme in believing that it is important to obtain understanding rather than accepting doctrine at face value, I would encourage the new batter not to accept what Ruth has to say as right just because he was the greatest slugger of all time. If I were that new batter, I wouldn't stop questioning Ruth until I was confident I had found the truth. A. If you can't successfully do something, don't think you can tell others how it should be done. I've seen some people who have repeatedly failed at something hold strongly to their opinions of how it should be done, even when their opinions are at odds with those who have repeatedly done it successfully. That is dumb and arrogant. They should instead ask questions and seek believability-weighted votes to help them get out of their intransigence. B. Remember that everyone has opinions, and they are often bad. Opinions are easy to produce. Everyone has plenty of them, and most people are eager to share them, even to fight for them. Unfortunately, many are worthless or even harmful, including a lot of your own. Principle 5.2. Find the most believable people possible who disagree with you and try to understand their reasoning. Having open-minded conversations with believable people who disagree with you is the quickest way to get an education and to increase your probability of being right. A. Think about people's believability in order to assess the likelihood that their opinions are good. While it pays to be open-minded, you also have to be discerning. Remember that the quality of the life you get will depend largely on the quality of the decisions that you make as you pursue your goals. The best way to make great decisions is to know how to triangulate with other, more knowledgeable people. So be discerning about whom you triangulate with and skilled in the way you do it. The dilemma you face is trying to understand as accurately as you can what's true in order to make decisions effectively, while realizing many of the opinions you will hear won't be worth much, including your own. Think about people's believability, which is a function of their capabilities and their willingness to say what they think. Keep their track records in mind. B. Remember that believable opinions are most likely to come from people, 1. Who have successfully accomplished the thing in question at least 3 times, and 2. Who have great explanations of the cause-effect relationships that led them to their conclusions. Treat those who have neither as not believable, those who have one as somewhat believable, and those who have both as the most believable. Be especially wary of those who comment from the stands without having played on the field themselves and who don't have good logic, as they are dangerous to themselves and others. C. If someone hasn't done something but has a theory that seems logical and can be stress-tested, then by all means test it. Keep in mind that you are playing probabilities. D. Don't pay as much attention to people's conclusions as to the reasoning that led them to their conclusions. It is common for conversations to consist of people sharing their conclusions rather than exploring the reasoning that led to those conclusions. As a result, there is an overabundance of confidently expressed bad opinions. E. Inexperienced people can have great ideas too, sometimes far better ones than more experienced people. That's because experienced thinkers can get stuck in their old ways. If you've got a good ear, you will be able to tell when an inexperienced person is reasoning well. Like knowing whether someone can sing, it doesn't take a lot of time. Sometimes a person only has to sing a few bars for you to hear how well they can sing. Reasoning is the same. It often doesn't take a lot of time to figure out if someone can do it. F. Everyone should be upfront in expressing how confident they are in their thoughts. A suggestion should be called a suggestion. A firmly held conviction should be presented as such, particularly if it's coming from someone with a strong track record in the area in question. Principle 5.3. Think about whether you are playing the role of a teacher, a student, or a peer, and whether you should be teaching, asking questions, or debating. Too often people flail in their disagreements because they either don't know or don't think about how they should engage effectively. They just blurt out whatever they think and argue. While everyone has the right and obligation to make sense of everything, basic rules for engagement should be followed. Those rules and how you should follow them depend on your relative believabilities. For example, it would not be effective for the person who knows less to tell the person who knows more how something should be done. It's important to get the balance between your assertiveness and your open-mindedness right, based on your relative levels of understanding of the subject. Think about whether the person you're disagreeing with is more or less believable than you. If you are less believable, you are more of a student and should be more open-minded, primarily asking questions in order to understand the logic of the person who probably knows more. If you're more believable, your role is more of teacher, primarily conveying your understanding and answering questions. And if you are approximate peers, you should have a thoughtful exchange as equals. When there is a disagreement about who is more believable, be reasonable and work it through. In cases when you can't do this alone effectively, seek out the help of an agreed-upon third party. In all cases, try to see things through the other person's eyes so that you can obtain understanding. All parties should remember that the purpose of debate is to get at truth, not to prove that someone is right or wrong, and that each party should be willing to change their mind based on the logic and evidence. A. It's more important that the student understand the teacher than that the teacher understand the student, though both are important. I've often seen less believable people, students, insist that the more believable people, teachers, understand their thinking and prove why the teacher is wrong before listening to what the teacher, the more believable party, has to say. That's backward. While untangling the student's thinking can be helpful, it is typically difficult and time-consuming and puts the emphasis on what the student sees instead of on what the teacher wants to convey. For that reason, our protocol is for the student to be open-minded first. Once the student has taken in what the teacher has to offer, both student and teacher will be better prepared to untangle and explore the student's perspective. It is also more time efficient to get in sync this way, which leads to the next principle. B. Recognize that while everyone has the right and responsibility to try to make sense of important things, they must do so with humility and radical open-mindedness. When you are less believable, start by taking on the role of a student in a student-teacher relationship, with appropriate humility and open-mindedness. While it is not necessarily you who doesn't understand, you must assume this until you have seen the issue through the other's eyes. If the issue still doesn't make sense to you and you think that your teacher just doesn't get it, appeal to other believable people. If you still can't reach an agreement, assume you are wrong. If, on the other hand, you are able to convince a number of believable people of your point of view, then you should make sure your thinking is heard and considered by the person deciding, probably with the help of the other believable party. Remember that those who are higher in the reporting hierarchy have more people they are trying to sort through on an expected value basis to get the best thinking, and more people who want to tell them what they think, so they are time-constrained and have to play the probabilities. If your thinking has been stress-tested by other believable people who support you, it has a greater probability of being heard. Conversely, those higher in the reporting hierarchy must strive to achieve the goal of getting in sync with those lower in the hierarchy about what makes sense. The more people get in sync about what makes sense, the more capable and committed people will be. Principle 5.4. Understand how people came by their opinions. Our brains work like computers. They input data and process it in accordance with their wiring and programming. Any opinion you have is made up of these two things: the data and your processing or reasoning. When someone says, "I believe X," ask them, "What data are you looking at? What reasoning are you using to draw your conclusion?" Dealing with raw opinions will get you and everyone else confused. Understanding where they come from will help you get to the truth. A. If you ask someone a question, they will probably give you an answer, so think through to whom you should address your questions. I regularly see people ask totally uninformed or non-believable people questions and get answers that they believe. This is often worse than having no answers at all. Don't make that mistake. You need to think through who the right people are. If you're in doubt about someone's believability, find out. The same is true for you. If someone asks you a question, think first whether you're the right person to answer it. If you're not believable, you probably shouldn't have an opinion about what they're asking, let alone share it. Be sure to direct your comments or questions to the believable, responsible party or parties for the issues you want to discuss. Feel free to include others if you think that their input is relevant, while recognizing that the decision will ultimately rest with whoever is responsible for it. B. Having everyone randomly probe everyone else is an unproductive waste of time. For heaven's sake, don't bother directing your questions to people who aren't responsible, or worse still, throw your questions out there without directing them at all. C. Beware of statements that begin with, "I think that." Just because someone thinks something doesn't mean it's true. Be especially skeptical of statements that begin with, "I think that I," since most people can't accurately assess themselves. D. Assess believability by systematically capturing people's track records over time. Every day is not a new day. Over time, a body of evidence builds up, showing which people can be relied on and which cannot. Track records matter, and at Bridgewater, tools such as baseball cards and the dot collector make everyone's track records available for scrutiny. Principle 5.5. Disagreeing must be done efficiently. Working oneself through disagreements can be time-consuming, so you can imagine how an idea meritocracy, where disagreement is not just tolerated but encouraged, could become dysfunctional if it's not managed well. Imagine how inefficient it would be if a teacher ran a large class by asking each of the students individually what they thought, and then debated with all of them, instead of conveying their own views first and taking questions later. People who want to disagree must keep this in mind and follow the tools and protocols for disagreeing well. A. Know when to stop debating and move on to agreeing about what should be done. I've seen people who agree on the major issues waste hours arguing over details. It's more important to do big things well than to do the small things perfectly. But when people disagree on the importance of debating something, it probably should be debated. Operating otherwise would essentially give someone, typically the boss, a de facto veto. B. Use believability weighting as a tool rather than a substitute for decision-making by responsible parties. Believability-weighted decision-making is a way of supplementing and challenging the decisions of responsible parties, not overruling them. As Bridgewater's system currently exists, everyone is allowed to give input, but their believability is weighted based on the evidence, their track records, test results, and other data. Responsible parties can overrule believability-weighted voting, but only at their peril. When a decision-maker chooses to bet on his own opinion over the consensus of believable others, he is making a bold statement that will be proven right or wrong by the results. C. Since you don't have the time to thoroughly examine everyone's thinking yourself, choose your believable people wisely. Generally speaking, it's best to choose three believable people who care a lot about achieving the best outcome and who are willing to openly disagree with each other and have their reasoning probed. Of course, the number three isn't set in stone. The group could be larger or smaller. Its ideal size depends on the amount of time available, how important the decision is, how objectively you can assess your own and others' decision-making abilities, and how important it is to have a lot of people understand the reasoning behind the decision. D. When you're responsible for a decision, compare the believability-weighted decision-making of the crowd to what you believe. When they're at odds, you should work hard to resolve the disagreement. If you're about to make a decision that the believability-weighted consensus thinks is wrong, think very carefully before you proceed. It's likely that you're wrong, but even if you're right, there's a good chance that you'll lose respect by overruling the process. You should try hard to get in sync, and if you still can't do that, you should be able to put your finger on exactly what it is you disagree with, understand the risks of being wrong, and clearly explain your reasons and logic to others. If you can't do those things, you probably should suspend your own judgment and go with the believability-weighted vote. Principle 5.6. Recognize that everyone has the right and responsibility to try to make sense of important things. There will come a point in all processes of thinking things through when you are faced with the choice of requiring the person who sees things differently from you to slowly work things through until you see things the same way, or going along with the other person even though their thinking still doesn't seem to make sense. I recommend the first path when you are disagreeing about something important, and the latter when it's unimportant. I understand that the first path can be awkward because the person you are speaking to can get impatient. To neutralize that, I suggest you simply say, "Let's agree that I am a dumb shit, but I still need to make sense of this, so let's move slowly to make sure that happens." One should always feel free to ask questions while remembering one's obligation to remain open-minded in the discussions that follow. Record your argument so that if you can't get in sync or make sense of things, you can send it out so others can decide. And of course, remember that you are operating in an idea meritocracy. Be mindful of your own believability. A. Communications aimed at getting the best answer should involve the most relevant people. As a guide, the most relevant people to probe are your managers, direct reports, and/or agreed experts. They are the most impacted by and most informed about the issues under discussion, and so they are the most important parties to be in sync with. If you can't get in sync, you should escalate the disagreement by raising it to the appropriate people. B. Communication aimed at educating or boosting cohesion should involve a broader set of people than would be needed if the aim were just getting the best answer. Less experienced, less believable people may not be necessary to decide an issue, but if the issue involves them and you aren't in sync with them, That lack of understanding will in the long run likely undermine morale and the organization's efficiency. This is especially important in cases where you have people who are both not believable and highly opinionated, the worst combination. Unless you get in sync with them, you will drive their uninformed opinions underground. If, on the other hand, you are willing to be challenged, you will create an environment in which all criticisms are aired openly. C. Recognize that you don't need to make judgments about everything. Think about who is responsible for something and their believability, how much you know about it and your own believability. Don't hold opinions about things you don't know anything about. Principle 5.7. Pay more attention to whether the decision-making system is fair than whether you get your way. An organization is a community with a set of shared values and goals. Its morale and smooth functioning should always take precedence over your need to be right. And besides, you could be wrong. When the decision-making system is consistently well-managed and based on objective criteria, the idea meritocracy is more important than the happiness of any one of its members, even if that member is you. Chapter 6. Recognize how to get beyond disagreements. It is the rare dispute that is resolved to both parties' equal satisfaction. Imagine you are having an argument with your neighbor about a tree of theirs that has fallen onto your property. Who is responsible for its removal? Who owns the firewood? Who pays for the damage? While you might not be able to resolve the disagreement yourselves, the legal system has procedures and guidelines that allow it to determine what's true and what to do about it. And once it renders its judgment, it's done, even if one of you didn't get what you wanted. That's just the way life is. At Bridgewater, our principles and policies work in essentially the same way, providing a path for settling disputes that's not unlike what you'd find in the courts, though it's less formal. Having such a system is essential in an idea meritocracy because you can't just encourage people to think independently and fight for what they believe is true. You also have to provide them with a way to get past their disagreements and move forward. Managing this well is especially important at Bridgewater because we have so much more thoughtful disagreement than other places. While in most cases people disagreeing can work things out on their own, it is still often the case that people can't agree on what's true and what to do about it. In those cases, we follow our procedures for believability-weighted voting and go with the verdict. Or in the cases where the RP wants to do it his or her way contrary to the vote and has the power to do so, we accept that and move on. In the end, people who join our idea meritocracy agree to abide by our policies and procedures and the decisions that come out of them, just as if they had taken a dispute to court and had to abide by its procedures and the resulting verdict. This requires them to separate themselves from their own opinion and avoid getting angry when a decision doesn't go their way. If people don't follow the agreed-upon paths, they don't have the right to complain about either the people they disagree with or the idea meritocratic system itself. In those rare cases where our principles, policies, and procedures fail to make clear how a disagreement should be resolved, it is everyone's responsibility to raise that fact so the process can be clarified and improved. Principle 6.1. Remember, principles can't be ignored by mutual agreement. Principles are like laws. You can't break one simply because you and someone else agree to break it. Remember that it's everyone's obligation to speak up, own it, or get out. If you don't think the principles provide the right way to resolve a problem or disagreement, you need to fight to change the principles, not just do what you want to do. A. The same standards of behavior apply to everyone. Whenever there is a dispute, both parties are required to have equal levels of integrity, to be open-minded and assertive, and to be equally considerate. The judges must hold the parties to the same standards and provide feedback consistent with these standards. I've often seen cases in which the feedback wasn't appropriately balanced for various reasons, to hold the stronger performer to a higher standard, to spread the blame. This is a mistake. The person in the wrong needs to receive the strongest message. Not operating this way could lead them to believe that the problem wasn't caused by them, or was caused by both parties equally. Of course, the message should be conveyed calmly and clearly rather than emotionally to maximize its effectiveness. Principle 6.2. Make sure people don't confuse the right to complain, give advice, and openly debate with the right to make decisions. Everyone does not report to everyone. Responsibilities and authorities are assigned to individuals based on assessments of their ability to handle them. People are given the authority that they need to achieve outcomes and are held accountable for their ability to produce them. At the same time, they are going to be stress tested from both directions, that is, by those they report to and by those who report to them. The challenging and probing that we encourage is not meant to second guess their every decision, but to improve the quality of their work over time. The ultimate goal of independent thinking and open debate is to provide the decision maker with alternative perspectives. It doesn't mean that decision-making authority is transitioned to those who are probing them. A. When challenging a decision and or a decision maker, consider the broader context. It's important to view individual decisions in the broadest possible context. For example, if the responsible party being challenged has a vision, and the decision being disputed involves a small detail of that overall vision, the decision needs to be debated and evaluated within the context of that larger vision. Principle 6.3. Don't leave important conflicts unresolved. While it's easier to avoid confrontations in the short run, the consequences of doing so can be massively destructive in the long term. It's critical that conflicts actually get resolved, not through superficial compromise, but through seeking the important, accurate conclusions. In most cases, this process should be made transparent to relevant others and sometimes the entire organization, both to ensure quality decision-making and to perpetuate the culture of openly working through disputes. A. Don't let the little things divide you when your agreement on the big things should bind you. Almost every group that agrees on the big things ends up fighting about less important things and becoming enemies, even though they should be bound by the big things. This phenomenon is called the narcissism of small differences. Take the Protestants and Catholics. Though both are followers of Christ, some of them have been fighting for hundreds of years, even though many of them are unable to articulate the differences that divide them, and most of those who can articulate the differences realize that they are insignificant relative to the big important things that should bind them together. I once saw a close family have an irrevocable blowout at Thanksgiving dinner over who would cut the turkey. Don't let this narcissism of small differences happen to you. Understand that nobody and nothing is perfect, and that you are lucky to have, by and large, excellent relationships. See the big picture. B. Don't get stuck in disagreement, escalate, or vote. By practicing open-mindedness and assertiveness, you should be able to resolve most disagreements. If not, and if your dispute is one-on-one, you should escalate to a mutually agreed-upon believable other. All things being equal, that should be someone higher in your reporting chain, such as your boss. When a group can't reach an agreement, the person responsible for the meeting should take a believability-weighted vote. Principle 6.4. Once a decision is made, everyone should get behind it even though individuals may still disagree. A decision-making group in which those who don't get what they want continue to fight rather than work for what the group has decided is destined to fail. You can see this happening all the time in companies, organizations, and even political systems and nations. I'm not saying that people should pretend they like the decision if they don't, or that the matter in question can't be revisited at a future date. What I am saying is that in order to be effective, all groups that work together have to operate with protocols that allow time for disagreements to be explored, but in which dissenting minority parties recognize that group cohesion supersedes their individual desires once they have been overruled. The group is more important than the individual. Don't behave in a way that undermines the chosen path. A. See things from the higher level. You are expected to go to the higher level and look down on yourself and others as part of a system. In other words, you must get out of your own head, consider your views as just some among many, and look down on the full array of points of view to assess them in an idea-meritocratic way, rather than just in your own possessive way. Seeing things from the higher level isn't just seeing other people's point of view. It's also being able to see every situation, yourself and others in the situation, as though you were looking down on them as an objective observer. If you can do this well, you will see the situation as another one of those. See it through everyone's eyes and have good mental maps or principles for deciding how to handle it. Almost all people initially find it difficult to get beyond seeing things through just their own eyes. So I've developed policies and tools such as the coach, which connects situations to principles, that help people do this. With practice, many people can learn to develop this perspective, though others never do. You need to know which type of person you and the people around you are. If you can't do this well on your own, seek the help of others. Recognize that many people cannot see things from the higher level and distinguish those who can from those who can't, and either get rid of those who can't or have good guardrails in place to protect yourself and the organization against this inability. By the way, it is of course okay to continue to disagree on some things as long as you don't keep fighting, thereby undermining the idea meritocracy. If you continue to fight the idea meritocracy, you must go. B. Never allow the idea meritocracy to slip into anarchy. In an idea meritocracy, there is bound to be more disagreement than in a typical organization. But when it's taken to an extreme, arguing and nitpicking can undermine the idea meritocracy's effectiveness. At Bridgewater, I have encountered some people, especially junior people, who mistakenly think they are entitled to argue about whatever they want and with whomever they please. I've even seen people band together to threaten the idea meritocracy, claiming that their right to do so comes from the principles. They misunderstand my principles and the boundaries within the organization. They must abide by the rules of the system, which provide paths for resolving disagreements, and they mustn't threaten the system. C. Don't allow lynch mobs or mob rule. Part of the purpose of having a believability-weighted system is to remove emotion from decision-making. Crowds get emotional and seek to grab control. That must be prevented. While all individuals have the right to have their own opinions, they do not have the right to render verdicts. Principle 6.5. Remember that if the idea meritocracy comes into conflict with the well-being of the organization, it will inevitably suffer. That's just a matter of practicality. As you know, I believe that what's good must work well, and that having the organization work well is of paramount importance. A. Declare martial law only in rare or extreme circumstances when the principles need to be suspended. While all these principles exist for the well-being of the community, there may come times when adhering to them could threaten the community's well-being. For example, we encountered a time when there were leaks to the media of some things that were made radically transparent within Bridgewater. People at Bridgewater understood that our transparency about our weaknesses and mistakes was being used to present distorted and harmful pictures of Bridgewater. So we had to lessen our level of transparency until we resolved that problem. Rather than just lessening this degree of transparency, I explained the situation and declared martial law, meaning that this was a temporary suspension of the full degree of radical transparency. That way everyone would know both that it was an exceptional case and that we were entering a time when the typical way of operating would be suspended. B. Be wary of people who argue for the suspension of the idea meritocracy for the good of the organization. When such arguments win out, the idea meritocracy will be weakened. Don't let that happen. If people respect the rules of the idea meritocracy, there will be no conflict. I know that from my experiences over decades. However, I also know that there will be people who put what they want above the idea meritocracy and threaten it. Consider those people to be enemies of the system and get rid of them. Principle 6.6. Recognize that if the people who have the power don't want to operate by principles, the principled way of operating will fail. Ultimately, power will rule. This is true of any system. For example, it has repeatedly been shown that systems of government have only worked when those with the power value the principles behind the system more than they value their own personal objectives. When people have both enough power to undermine a system and a desire to get what they want that is greater than their desire to maintain the system will fail. For that reason, the power supporting the principles must be given only to people who value the principled way of operating more than their individual interests or the interests of their faction, and people must be dealt with in a reasonable and considerate way so that the overwhelming majority will want and fight for that principle-based system. To get the people right. While we talked about an organization's culture in the last section, its people are even more important because they can change the culture for better or for worse.